You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Tom McCarthy's first novel, Remainder, was critically acclaimed. Zadie Smith called it one of the great English novels of the last 10 years. And last week it was announced his latest, C, and that's just the letter C, has been shortlisted for the Booker Prize. It's been published here by Knopf, and in a front-page review in last Sunday's New York Times Book Review, Jennifer Egan called it an intellectually provocative novel that unfurls like a brooding, phosphorescent dream. Wow, high praise. I'm pleased that it has brought Tom McCarthy back to the Leonard Lopate Show today. Tom, good to have you with us.
Nice to be here again.
It's nice to read a review like that, isn't it?
It's nice when they, yeah, absolutely.
And poetic, too.
Poetic review.
indeed.
Let alone book.
You know, the first thing that strikes me about this is just the title. See, it's as simple as it gets for a title.
It's right? Like Sesame Street,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
brought to you by the letter C.
Why? Why C?
Well, I guess the genesis of this book involves, I was kind of interested in these two figures, Carter and Carnarvon, this double act that went and dug up Tutankhamun in 1922.
So it got started with that.
That, and as a kind of marker, I wanted to make a composite of the two and of several other kind of historical and fictional figures too. But I thought, okay, Carter, Carnarvon, let's just call it C for now.
Mm-hmm.
But then this letter C was kind of intriguing, and you know, the novel involves lots of things that begin with C, like cyanide that the mm-hmm. hero's sister poisons mm-hmm. herself with, and cocaine. He becomes a cocaine addict during the war, and cysteine and calls. He's born with a call
born
on his head.
On his head
he's
yeah.
listening to the radio. It's all about call signs. And finally, I didn't even know this because I never really studied chemistry in school, but C, the letter C, is the chemical sign for carbon, which is the basic element of all life.
So
it
bingo.
Kind of sense.
All,
yeah,
of a sudden,
bingo,
exactly. All of a sudden there you got a title, don't
exactly.
you? Yeah. So tell us a little, it is you drew from historical characters.
Mm-hmm.
It's set in early 20th century
yeah.
and fascination with radio.
Emergent kind of.
The emergent technology of the time, yeah. the internet of its time.
Oh,
if
totally.
You will.
The World Wide Web of,
right.
of yeah.
Tell us, give us a little plot synopsis and maybe that could take us to a little reading.
Okay, well, it's set between 1898 and 1922, which is kind of exactly the period between Marconi's very first tentative wireless experiments, where he was euphoric if he could bounce a signal, you know, jump a signal 10 meters or something, at the one end, and at the other end, 22, which is when the BBC is formed. In other words, this kind of anarchic many-to-many multiple networks period that so perfectly mirrors mm-hmm. the period from the 90s to now of the internet. This period is closed down, and you get a central broadcaster. But 22 is also the great year of literary modernism, right? It's the year that Ulysses is published. And even more relevantly, perhaps, The Wasteland, which I see as a kind of radio poem. You've got mm-hmm. these, it's like going through the dial. You've got voices dropping in, dropping out, fragmenting, breaking up. So that's when the novel's set. Yeah.
So after 22, it becomes less interesting in a sense because it's not as
it's
random.
Kind of completed yeah. a certain yeah. cycle. It's been yeah. centralized and regulated and brought under a control. Having said that, I mean, I think this is probably apparent already. I don't see this as a historical novel at all. That's a kind of red herring. I mean, it's really about communication and the situation we're in now in relation to media.
But you wanted to set it in this time for the
yeah.
purpose because of the parallel it makes to our time?
I think so. I think paradoxically it's easier to talk about the present indirectly. You
mm-hmm,
know,
sure.
Walter Benjamin, the philosopher, famously says that the angel of history faces backwards in order to move forwards. And I think, you know, literature's like that too. If you want to understand the present or even hint at the future, you kind of, the only route to do that is through the past.
Hindsight is 20/20. So that
exactly.
the main character, Serge, tell us about him.
Okay, so he's born with a call on his head. Well, his
which
dad
is good luck, supposedly.
Which is meant to be good luck,
right.
Yeah, especially to sailors. And but it's a kind of veil over his head, and he lives his life behind a veil. I mean, veil images keep coming up again and again. He grows up on a kind of quite idyllic, kind of Arcadian country estate. His dad runs a day school for deaf children, kind of teaching them to speak and writing out phonetic letters everywhere. So he's kind of surrounded by language and silence. And then his sister dies. Then he goes into World War One. He becomes an observer. Again, like the angel of history, facing backwards from at the back of an aeroplane over this scene of devastation. He gets addicted to coke and heroin and spends some time in London in the Roaring Twenties and then ends up in Egypt among among the tombs of the ancients. So he kind of moves from one family crypt to another, basically.
Right. Now, going back to the father who teaches the deaf, mm-hmm. and his mother was deaf as
well. Was deaf.
Is that all about the communication thing? Was that some sort of nod to Alexander Graham Bell?
Oh, totally, yeah.
Okay.
So Alexander Graham Bell's mother was deaf and his wife was deaf, mm-hmm. and his father taught on a school for the deaf. And but there's more to it than that, actually. Alexander Bell had two brothers, and one of them died when they were quite young. And the two remaining brothers said, if another of us should die, let's make a pact that the remaining one will invent a device capable of communicating with the dead, just in case there turns out to be an afterlife. And then the other brother did die. They had tuberculosis around the family. And Alex invents the telephone, right? And he remained a rationalist forever. He never ended up believing in an afterlife, basically because his brother never called. So you know, but the technology.
But he had the phone there ready.
He had the phone there ready, and so the technology itself is kind of haunted by that desire, by that kind of mourning, if you like, or by that melancholia. That's what interests me. The idea of technology as kind of embodying a form of melancholia.
So, do you think technology? Net is a negative to us, or does it bring us together? What are you driving at?
Well, it does both. I mean, I wouldn't say it's negative, but it's definitely, you know, while I was researching this book, it's not just the telephone, it's the radio, and almost every emergent communication technology, when you look into its invention, you often find a dead sibling, one link down the chain, or two links, or a dead family member. It's really tied in with kind of bereavement. You know, it's kind of interesting. I don't know if I can explain why, but it's just, you know, if something crops up 2-3 times, it's not a coincidence anymore. You get the
impression. And that subject, I don't want to do spoiler alert here, but that subject is dealt with in this book.
Oh, totally. I mean,
right at the center of this book.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a dead sibling inhabiting the airwaves throughout this book. Yeah, totally.
Why don't you read us a little passage?
Okay, I'll read a passage from quite early on when Serge is one of these radio bugs going through the ether in there. This is 1911. You don't hear voices, you hear clicks against the static. Serge moves the dial up to 500 meters. Here are stronger, more decisive signals. Coastal stations, call signs flung from towering masts. Poldhu's transmitting its weather report. A few nudges away, Malin, Cleethorpes, Nordyke send out theirs. Liverpool's exchanging messages with tugboats in the Mersey. Serge transcribes a rota of towing duties for tomorrow. Further out, the lightship Tongues reporting a derelict's position. The coordinates click their way into the Seaforth station, then flash out again to be acknowledged by Marconi operators of commercial liners, one after the other. The ship's names reel off in litany. Falaba, British Sun, Scania, Morea, Carmania, each name appendaged by its church, Cunard Line, Allen, Aberdeen Direct, Canadian Pacific Railway, Holland America. The clicks peter out, and Serge glances at the clock. It's 1:30 before 1. A few seconds later, Paris's call sign comes on, FL, for Eiffel. Serge taps his finger on the desktop to the rhythm of the huge tower's standby clicks, then holds it still and erect for the silent lull that always comes just before the time code. All the operators have gone silent. Boats, coastal stations, bugs, all waiting, like him, for the quarter-second dots to set the air, the world, time itself back in motion as they chime the hour.
You know, you're describing a boy. How old was he at this point?
Oh, he's about like 13.
13,
yeah.
Listening to a bunch of clicks, and yet the world comes alive, doesn't it?
Yeah, totally. I mean, you've got this noise, this static, what the German poet Rilke called Geräusch, the kind of roar and crackle of the universe. And against that, you've got clicks, either long or short, that correspond to the dots and dashes of Morse code. And these kids, I mean, they were mainly kind of young men who'd clobbered together DIY little listening stations. They would transcribe these and write them down. And then underneath the dots and dashes, they'd render it as words. And then what I've got in my kind of imagination of it is this kind of image track emerging in his head as he goes further and further up the dial. And he starts picking up Africa and he starts thinking of kind of tents laid out beneath red desert skies. And I mean, the writer William Burroughs said when he wrote, what he was doing was transcribing a film he was seeing in his head.
Right,
and this
right.
is kind of almost the opposite. This first the noise, then the writing, then the film. kind of emerges. So it's what now we'd call a multimedia experience. I'm kind of interested in the way the different forms of media overlap or produce one another.
But what, yeah, and when you say that, I'm thinking about the experience that my son would have today, connecting with the world, and it's, you know, YouTube and all the other, and we don't have that opportunity to listen to clicks and turn the clicks into an image in our brain. Have we lost something along the way?
We probably have, but we've regained something as well. I mean, I guess the interface is doing it for us, right? There's the bits and bytes, but there's still, I think, there's something magic about the internet. This kind of,
so it doesn't hurt our imaginations. You think we just imagine in different ways?
Yeah, I think like Hamlet says, nothing is either good or bad, but thinking makes it. So I think technology is like that. You know, we can bomb people or create, you know, cut up poetry with it. I mean, it's kind of what we do with it that counts.
Yeah. Now you have characters here who are grappling with drug addiction issues. Mm-hmm. Well, why was that theme important to you?
Well, I don't know. I found out one of the slang terms for heroin is sister. Which is kind of very interesting, given that Serge loses his sister, mm-hmm. and I found out that during World War One, lots of pilots did indeed become morphine addicted. I
mean, they did.
It was in their toolkit, and it was meant to be used for pain, but they discovered it was actually a lot of fun, and so they got a bit too fond of their chemistry.
Could make it tough to fly the next day.
I have these passages where I just imagine him up in the air and all the tracer fires going past him, and it's kind of beautiful, and it's like party bunting, and he's just amidst these trajectories of smoke and cordite, and it's kind of, he likes it. He likes the war a lot, but I like the idea that, you know, he's kind of injecting this black matter into him, which is the very thing he's lost, and it's kind of running and coursing through his veins.
You like to explore how things work, don't you? I mean, were you the kind of guy who, you know, I don't know, Heath kits or whatever? Did you build things when you were little, or you know, where does that come from?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know if I could even wire a plug now. I mean, I'm not particularly technological. I just like more than how things work, I like this kind of sense of how things resonate together. You know, how one thing can transform, or a word can transform an image, and then, you know, kind of networks of association. I mean, that's what literature is about, ultimately.
Right, right. But it's incredible detail on the mechanics of things, isn't it? You know?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, the mechanics of things turn out to be quite poetic in and of themselves. I mean, this idea that
as long as the engineer doesn't write it, it's poetic, right? Right.
Well, sometimes even engineering manuals can have a kind of poetry to them. Yeah.
You've read a lot of them, I guess.
Yeah, some of them get kind of wound into the text in this book.
You're also a visual artist. Tell us about that.
Well, I this book came out of an art project I was doing at the Institute of Contemporary Arts in London that involved setting up a radio station and transmitting messages that were made by slicing up other media and recombining it, like newspapers and things. So, I mean, ultimately it was quite a literary project, but it was hosted by an art institute. So I think there's a quite a lot of, I mean, I don't really see them as separate. When I'm doing something in an arts institution, I've got the same concerns. It's the same project, the same Gesamtkunstwerk or whatever, as they say in German, right. But it's just in a different medium.
So it's the same thing for you. It's just different sides of the brain or whatever you
exactly,
want to say.
Exactly, yeah.
What is the International Necronautical Society? Tell me
well,
about that.
Well, that's a kind of project that's played out over the last 10 years and continues to take place, mainly through arts institutions. It's a network. I'm interested in networks, and I'm kind of interested in that. I have this fascination with the avant-garde of the early 20th centuries, you know, the way that instead of the individual great artist expressing himself or herself, you'd have a group of people, a committee with a manifesto, and then they'd have schisms and expulsions and so on. I'm quite, you know, I find that very intriguing, and it's quite funny as well. So about 10 years ago I set up my own network that is not without irony and not without humor, but it's kind of serious as well, and I appointed philosophers and artists and writers to be different, you know, to posts within this network, and then art institutions started picking up on it and saying, would you like to come and make a declaration here, or would you like to kind of publish something or exhibit something? And so it's just, I like to describe it as a kind of, it's a fiction that kind of becomes real once it's hosted, like a kind of virus that does something once it finds a, a foothold in some other body.
Are you experimenting? I think somewhere you don't like that term so much.
Well, I think the term experimental, I mean, the term, you know, C has been described as experimental fiction quite a bit. And I'm kind of a bit suspicious of that. I suspect that it's a term that lazy journalists or critics often use to kind of sideline work that doesn't conform to a certain model of, you know, kind of sentimental, humanist kind of mainstream fiction. But at the same time, I mean, yeah, it is. I think any good art in any medium is conducting some kind of experiment, right? Otherwise, it's just genre. I mean, it's somehow negotiating or feeling its way around the boundaries of its own form. And this is true. This doesn't just apply to modernist avant-garde stuff. This is what Cervantes or Shakespeare are doing. You know, we forget how radical something like Hamlet is. It's been so heritaged, but it kind of subverts or inverts virtually every convention that it's purportedly buys into, like the revenge tragedy and this and that. And
so the worst sin is to be safe.
Yeah.
Now tell me about being on the Booker shortlist. What does that mean to you? Is that's a big deal?
I guess so. I mean, it is. I'm surprised. I didn't think. I'm surprised, and my publisher's very happy. You know, you got to keep these. Of course, it's nice, but you got to keep these things in perspective. I mean, Kafka never won no prize, right? Metamorphosis sold 11 copies in its first year, and it turns out 10 of these were bought by Kafka. So, I mean, you know,
very good point.
You know, conversely, you look back at who won the Pulitzer the year that, I know, The Sound and the Fury was published, and it's like, who? You know,
careful what you embrace.
It's nice to be on the prize list, but one shouldn't think that makes the book any better, you know, or worse.
History is a different way of judging us, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think these things take 50 years to kind of really establish what was important and what wasn't.
Do you have something else in the works?
Oh yeah,
book is called D.
Well, funnily, no, it's not. But but D is a big character in it. C is the third novel, so it's C and.
So
I want D to play a prominent role in the next book.
So you're gonna pick up on this theme, then, you think?
I think so. I mean, almost everything I've done is somehow a continuation of everything else. I mean, there's the same themes, kind of a relation to media, to technology, to melancholia, to repetition, to desire. I mean, and I think I don't see it. I've barely scratched the surface, I think.
There's plenty left to write. All right. Well, thank you very much.
A pleasure. Real pleasure.
I've been speaking with Tom McCarthy, whose latest novel, C, the letter C, is published by Knopf, and that begins with a K, not a C. Tom McCarthy will be reading and signing books at McNally Jackson tonight at 7 p.m. That's on Prince Street between Lafayette and Mulberry. Be there. For more information, you can head to our show page at WNYC.org. Tom, thanks again.
Pleasure.